Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the extension by a week of the deadline for the P5+1 negotiations with Iran in Vienna, after the parties failed to reach an agreement by the June 30th deadline. Nada Hashemi, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Kobel School of International Studies at the University of Denver, joins us to discuss the likelihood that a deal will be made in spite of a last-minute spoiler from Iran's supreme leader that appeared to backtrack from the framework agreement reached in April. We will also discuss Nada Hashemi's article in the Cairo Review of Global Affairs, How a Nuclear Deal Helps Democracy in Iran. Then we'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times, Michael Hiltzik, about two major Californian stories making news today. The first is Governor Jerry Brown's signing of the nation's toughest new mandatory vaccination law that will end exemptions from state immunization laws based on religious or other personal beliefs. And the second is the Supreme Court's agreement to take up a case that could weaken public sector unions in a challenge by 10 non-union public school teachers who claim California's requirement that they pay union dues violates their free speech rights. Then finally, we'll examine the scandal-plagued record of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who is the 14th entrant into the crowded Republican presidential primary field, joining a race in which his poll numbers indicate 55% of Republican primary voters cannot envision voting for him, making Christie only slightly more palatable than the bombastic racist buffoon Donald Trump. Robert Hennelly, a contributing writer at Salon, reporter for CBS News' Money Watch, and a political analyst for WBGO, an NPR affiliate in Newark, New Jersey, joins us to discuss the gulf between Christie's ego and New Jersey's tattered economy. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Kobel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. His latest book is The Syria Dilemma, and he has an article at the Cairo Review of Global Affairs, How a Nuclear Deal Helps Democracy in Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Happy to be with you, Ian.
And obviously there's been a lot of talk that they're going to miss the deadline in these P5+1 talks in Vienna, and clearly that has happened, but the sky hasn't fallen. There's been an extension for a week, I understand.
That's correct. It was just announced today that the extension has, taken place. So July 7th is the official date. And I think this suggests that we are close to getting to a final deal, but there are still unresolved issues that are on the table.
Well, Iran's foreign minister, of course, is in Vienna, Mohammad Javad Zarif. He's also there with President Hassan Rouhani's brother, who I've not heard about before. What kind of a role does he play?
Well, he's a close confidant and advisor to the president. He's been involved in these negotiations from day one, and he's just part of the foreign policy team. So his role is that of an advisor, supporter of Iran's president. To what extent he brings any foreign policy expertise to the table, I'm not sure, but I suspect he's there simply because he's a trusted sort of member of President Rouhani's foreign policy team.
So given that there's a one-week extension here, that would indicate that they're pretty close to an agreement, wouldn't it?
I would agree. I think they're pretty close. I think the sticking points really are the points that I think we talked about last time we had this conversation about Iran. It's really boils down to how can the leadership of the Islamic Republic of Iran accept a nuclear agreement that they can then sell back home, particularly to the hardline constituency that does not want to give any concessions and wants to sort of save face. The regime in particular, the Iranian regime, wants to save face so they can make a claim that they have not caved in, that they have not given concessions. And that's very much what the Supreme Leader's speech was all about last week, claiming that there would be no humiliating inspections of our military sites, that there was a demand for the immediate lifting of all sanctions against Iran, while the P5+1 countries have a different view on this. So it's really a question of how do you finesse those sort of differences. And then fundamentally, I think it really boils down to how can the Iranian regime sign a deal where they can save face and then they can make a claim back to their own population that we have stood firm against the imperial powers that were trying to humiliate us, we've gotten a good deal, and then we can move forward.
Well, there's a considerable amount of money at stake, isn't there? There's about $120 billion of frozen funds that would be released. Obviously, that's quite an influx of cash.
It's huge. It's not just the frozen funds, but it's also the potential of opening up the Iranian market to foreign investors, to international business, the unfreezing of monetary exchanges. So Iran has a huge incentive, economically speaking, to sign on to the deal, which is really, I think, why they're at the table. So the potential economic windfall, not only for the Iranian government, but for the Iranian people, is immense. And so I think that is really what the incentive is here from the Iranian side.
And again, I'm speaking with Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He is the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is The Syria Dilemma. And he has an article at the Cairo Review of Global Affairs, How a Nuclear Deal Helps Democracy in Iran. And in terms of your article in the Cairo Review of Global Affairs, give us a quick sort of summary of your points that you make in this article.
Yeah, the overarching point here is that a nuclear deal would be good for restarting and revitalizing the struggle for democracy in Iran, primarily because the sectors of Iranian society that have been most adversely affected by the economic sanctions have been civil society and the urban middle class, which is the core base of support for the pro-democracy movement. But having said that, I also mentioned in my article that, you know, over the last 5 to 6 years, since the last sort of outburst of pro-democracy protests in 2009 related to the rise of the Green Movement, that actually the prospects for democracy in Iran have contracted and authoritarianism has been strengthened in Iran due to the convergence of a set of factors at the international level, the regional level, and the domestic level. And of course, at the international level, I just hinted at what those factors were. The conflict with the United States, the economic sanctions, have all worked in a very negative direction with respect to the prospects for democracy. Regionally, I also discuss in my article, is that the chaos that we're seeing in the Middle East, the rise of ISIS, the rise of Salafi jihadism, the imploding of states, has actually also worked very negatively against the prospects for democracy in Iran. There's a deep fear that demanding quick political change could turn Iran into another Syria or another Iraq or another sort of, Egypt. So the regional context has actually has not been conducive for the prospects for democracy in Iran. And of course, domestically, the regime is still highly repressive. It is still sort of paranoid over allowing public sentiments to be expressed. But I do sort of try to end the article on a note of caution and a note of cautious optimism. And that optimism is that, you know, if the international context, the threat of war against Iran, the lifting of sanctions, if that can change, which I think, you know, could happen in the aftermath of signing a nuclear agreement, that will actually create better sort of circumstances domestically in Iran for Iran's pro-democracy movement to revitalize itself and to push forward with its demands, largely because this regime in Iran, despite its pretensions and despite its claims, suffers from a deep crisis of legitimacy for reasons that I talk about in the article. And I think it's important that, you know, when we talk about the nuclear deal with Iran, we also talk about the consequences that a nuclear deal could have for domestic Iranian politics. And one of those positive consequences is that it could open up new doors and avenues and possibilities for democratic engagement, mobilization. And that's really why I wrote the article, because all of the debate here in the West about Iran's the Iran nuclear negotiations have all been about, you know, the what does this mean for Western security interests? What does it mean for Western allies? What does it mean for the, you know, so-called moderate Arab states in the region? But there's been zero discussion of what this means for the Iranian people, and specifically what this nuclear agreement could mean for the prospects for political change. So that's really what the article was seeking to address.
Well, it doesn't make sense that the hardliners would put themselves out of power since they have consolidated power. They control the choice of who gets to lead the country. They dominate the parliament. They control the military. They control the secret police. The IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, have their own sources of income. They've been making a fortune off smuggling Iranian embargoed oil through Iraq. So they're not likely to give up the privileges they have, particularly the mullahs, a lot of whom have become incredibly rich. But I take it that they're also aware that would there not be a social explosion in Iran if the deal collapses and it's clear that the hardline has scuttled it? I mean, I get the feeling there's a lot of pent-up expectation inside of Iran.
No, I totally agree with your assessment, Ian. I think that's also one of the reasons why Iran has come to the bargaining table. You know, we have good evidence, and, you know, we can talk about the evidence, but after Rouhani was elected 2 years ago, he approached the Supreme Leader and effectively sort of made an argument similar to the one that you just articulated, that unless we solve this nuclear problem with the international community, then the prospects for economic collapse and then a social disruption are going to increase precipitously. And the Supreme Leader sort of listened to him and sort of gave him the green light to try and strike a nuclear deal that could preserve Iran's interests and prevent precisely the collapse of Iran's economy and then most likely a coming social explosion. So I think that's also a big reason why the regime has proceeded with these negotiations. They feel that it will give them an extended lease on their political life. It will stabilize Iran. Iran's economy, of course, will benefit immediately, and that will stabilize the regime. But of course, you know, that still doesn't address, I think, the Achilles heel of the regime, where the regime is most weakest and where it suffers its greatest threat, and that's from society itself. You know, 2/3 of Iranians are under the age of 35. They're highly educated, globalized, deeply alienated from political Islamist rule. They're politically secular, and they desire meaningful and substantive political change, albeit gradually and nonviolently. So I think if we, you know, project a little bit farther down the road, we can see that the social, you know, conditions for political change and for democracy actually do look much better than most people realize. But you're right, you know, the hardliners are not going to concede power. But, you know, creating a more stable internal political environment does allow for greater political agitation, mobilization, pushback against the regime. And then it's just a question of waiting for the ripe opportunity that might open the door for meaningful and lasting change. And that is completely, you know, unpredictable. No one knows when those moments arrive. But if one looks at the balance of power and one looks at sort of the social and political conditions in Iran, this is a society that I think is ripe for political change. And unfortunately, as I've argued, and most people realize, the policies that have been pursued by the United States of threatening Iran, possibly bombing Iran, sanctioning Iran, all of that has worked to the detriment of civil society and to the detriment of the pro-democracy movement. So the hope is that if we can get to a deal, then that will, you know, shift the playing field, so to speak, in the direction of more stability, which will only benefit, you know, the forces of democracy that that are very, I think, active and hungry and interested in political change. So I think there's some cautious optimism here that if we can get to a nuclear deal, one of the benefits, at least for the people of Iran and for the long-term future of Iran's political stability, will look much better in the aftermath of a nuclear deal than it does today.
Well, Nada Hashemi, assuming that they do get a deal in a week's time, which is, I think, a reasonable assumption. Dr. Trita Parsi and Paul Pillow, the former head of the National Intelligence Council on the Middle East at the CIA, wrote a piece recently suggesting that there could be a war between Hezbollah and Israel in the summer, and that this would have the effect of scuttling the deal because rockets would be raining down on Israel and all the Democrats who support the deal would swing back into the Republican fold, and that would be a way to scuttle the deal. That's a speculation, of course, but is there a chance that because essentially Iran now is propping up Assad almost entirely, he's run out of soldiers and cannon fodder, could the Iranians, once they make the deal with the P5+1, somehow ease Assad out of there and make a last-minute settlement to avoid the prospect of a war with Israel?
You know, Ian, I don't think so. I think everything that we have heard and seen from the government in Iran is that it's willing to back the Assad regime till the end, for reasons that I think are really rooted in Iran's geostrategic sort of vision for the Middle East. It views Assad as the key sort of ally and its conduit to Hezbollah, which is, you know, a big part of its of Iran's regional influence. So I think Iran is hoping actually to reap the economic benefits of a nuclear deal and then sort of invest them, not all of them, but some of them, in sustaining the Assad regime and then supporting Hezbollah. So that's what the, I think, plan is from Iran's perspective. But as everyone knows, or anyone knows who's following what's happening in Syria today, as you just hinted, Assad's hold on power is quickly slipping away. He's much weaker than he was militarily. Economically, he's hurting. Iran can sustain him, but I don't think they can keep him alive. So I think the question that you ask really is an unknown question. Will the Iran nuclear deal sort of open up doors for a settlement in Syria? I don't think so in the immediate term. I think Iran is going to continue to support Assad. It might be open to striking some sort of deal where its interests in Syria related to its access to Lebanon and to Hezbollah are preserved in some way, if there's some sort of, I don't know, carve-up of Syria or an Alawite sort of state that borders, let's say, Lebanon, where Iran can have access to that sort of Alawite mini-state. That might be something that, you know, can be wrestled away from the Iranians. But I don't think that's, you know, on the horizon anytime soon. But as your question rightly hints at, and I think suggests, the regional situation in the Middle East is extremely volatile. There's a number of sort of balls that are being juggled or that are sort of in the air at the same time, and we don't know how they're going to fall and hit the ground and what the consequences are going to be. But and it's very difficult to predict with certainty what will happen. But, you know, you're right to point to the centrality of Syria. I think the future of Syria and the future of the Middle East now are deeply intertwined, and what happens in Syria will affect all of the major political actors, including the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Just in closing, Nada Hashemi, the one thing that seems to have changed, and it doesn't get a lot of attention, that is the fact that Saudi Arabia is now being ruled by a boy king who's 29 years old and who's a really hardline Wahhabi, had no education outside of Saudi Arabia, has prosecuted this war against the poorest Arab country on the planet, Yemen, with devastating humanitarian effects, destroying ancient antiquities in wanton destruction through the Saudi air power, all of which, of course, is they bought from the US. We're supposed to be there offering them logistical and intelligence support while they devastate World Heritage sites. And that is a part of this obscurantist Wahhabi philosophy or ideology that is so much of what the Islamic State is about. And they're poised to destroy the ancient Roman city of Palmyra, which is entirely in keeping with Saudi Wahhabi ideology. This is a really scary dimension, I think, of what's happening. It's underreported. And the more you look at the Saudis, the more you think, my God, we better make a deal with the Iranians because, you know, they're so much more rational. And at the end of the day, we've been tied to this in this sick relationship with the Saudis for so long that it doesn't seem to be justified in any possible way.
Ian, you know, we would actually need a separate show to do justice to the topic of the negative effects that have flown out of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and that have contaminated the politics, not just of the Middle East. I mean, you mentioned Yemen and the destruction there, but I would argue that have contaminated the politics of large sections of the Islamic world in terms of the spread of this very puritanical, ultra-conservative and anti-human interpretation of Islam that has wreaked havoc not only on Muslim societies, but has fueled sectarianism and has also fueled these recent terrorist attacks. I mean, just to cite one example, this young Tunisian kid who massacred, over 30 sort of foreign tourists on a beach, you know, was informed by a particular Salafi jihadist sort of mentality that can be traced back to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the preachings that come out of that particular sort of Wahhabi school of thought that unfortunately has in many ways gone mainstream in the Sunni Muslim world and has taken on radical dimensions, of which ISIS is one manifestation, but you know, it's starting to affect, you know, the entire world. So this is a part of the part of the politics of the Middle East and part of sort of U.S. foreign policy that unfortunately has not gotten the attention that it deserves. But I think there's going to be no long-lasting stability in the Middle East or beyond the Middle East until this virus of Wahhabi Islam is fundamentally contained and then rolled back.
And, of course, it was a Saudi that blew up the Shia mosque in Kuwait.
Exactly. It was inspired by the same sort of teachings, the same mentality. In this case, you know, inspired by those teachings and by the example of ISIS. ISIS laid claim to that particular bombing. But the inspiration of this particular brand of Islam, which is important for your listeners to know, historically speaking, is very recent in the Islamic world. It can be traced back to 30, 40 years. Now it's gone sort of unfortunately mainstream, and it is wreaking the havoc that we've been witnessing over the last several years.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Nada Hashemi.
Happy to be with you, Ian. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Nada Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. And his latest book is The Syria Dilemma. And he has an article at the Cairo Review of Global Affairs, How a Nuclear Deal Helps Democracy in Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times, Michael Hiltzig, talking about two major California stories making news today. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Hiltzig, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times, where he writes the daily blog The Economy Hub. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry, and he writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, covering business and economic issues relevant to life in California. And his books include Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century, and The New Deal, A Modern History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hiltzig.
It's good to be back with you, Ian.
And on Tuesday, Governor Brown signed this new, very tough new vaccination law. It closes a loophole that's existed in the law where people can opt out of immunizing their children based on personal beliefs. And it was fairly vigorously challenged. And so what do you think is the outcome here, given that the parents who object basically are going to pull their kids out of school and homeschool them or feel that that's their only option? is their bark worse than their bite, or do you think there's something like that that's going to happen?
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be that much of that. In fact, this law closes two loopholes. It closes not only the personal belief loophole, but the religious belief loophole. Now, you may find some parents with intense religious beliefs, maybe not homeschooling, but finding some sort of parochial school that will accept them. But I think what really had happened and what this law recognized and was fighting was the fact that a lot of these personal beliefs were casual. They weren't that deeply held. They were opportunistic. That is, parents were inclined to believe that, well, maybe vaccines are safe, but maybe they're not so safe, so we will put some of them off or we'll wait. They weren't really holding these beliefs very intensely, and now that the options have really shrunk for them, they've either got to get those vaccinations if they want their child to attend school, or they need to homeschool. I think most of them are basically going to go ahead and get the vaccinations, enroll their children in school. Schools are not going to be able to offer these sorts of exemptions. That's what we were seeing. We were seeing schools being increasingly tolerant of unvaccinated children until it became very clear that this was going to be a public health problem.
So who has been supporting this minority group of parents who have been very vocal? They had a number of demonstrations up in Sacramento, one of which was joined by Bobby Kennedy Jr., who made some unfortunate remarks that he later retracted, making an analogy with vaccinating children and the Holocaust. Who have you identified as being the groups behind trying to keep this exemption going?
Well, there are any number of anti-vaccine groups. Some of them have a religious underpinning. More often than not, they have sort of a generalized suspicion of government, suspicion of bureaucracy, and in fact, suspicion of the medical profession that animates them. And as we know from studies that have been done and experiences that physicians and others have had, once they get these ideas into their head, it's very hard to dislodge them. The rational arguments, scientific arguments that you present, don't seem to make much of a dent. So they feel that they're fighting against powerful interests. They feel that they're fighting against a pharmaceutical industry that doesn't have their best wishes, and they basically grasp essentially fraudulent studies or inadequate studies that have been put out linking vaccines to all sorts of ailments, especially autism. These have been widely debunked, but as I said, it's very hard to dislodge these feelings among some people once they have it in their head that they're fighting the good fight.
Well, it was my understanding, and I may be wrong, that the lobbying group that was behind it was the lobbying group for chiropractors.
Well, that may be some of it, though I think a lot of chiropractors understand that vaccines are important. You know, chiropractors and other practitioners, non-physician practitioners, had a role in dealing with vaccines under the previous regime. You could get an exemption from a chiropractor, from an osteopath, from a naturopath in California. So they may have had a vested interest in continuing the system where you were allowed to have questions. Non-vaccination was tolerated over the years, but it really did get out of hand, and the outbreak of measles that we saw at the end of last year really sort of solidified everybody's thinking on this.
Well, I think it became clear that people recognized that this exemption and the growth of non-immunized children at school was putting at risk everybody else, including very, very young babies. And actually, there have been cases of newborns dying and being, you know, crippled for life, in effect. So,
well, I think that's true. I think over time, as measles became sort of a quaint ailment of the past, and most people had no experience with it because the vaccination had been so successful, the idea that going without vaccinations was a potential danger became sort of abstract, and people didn't really appreciate it. And when you don't have the threat before you, you may begin to feel that, you know, things would go either way. It's not that important. Well, it took that measles outbreak to remind everybody that this is a dangerous disease, and it is important to get vaccinated. And I think the California state legislature and the governor responded exactly as they should have to this.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Hiltzik, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times, where he writes the daily blog The Economy Hub. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry, and he writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, which covers business and economic issues relevant to life in California. And his books include Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century, and The New Deal, A Modern History. Let's turn to the other big California story that the Supreme Court on Tuesday agreed to hear a major challenge to California's public unions, deciding whether they may charge fees to non-members to support collective bargaining. And this case before the Supreme Court could determine the future of public employee unions because it would undermine their economic viability.
Yes, that's right. Well, this is the so-called Friedrichs case, which was brought really by a conservative group. Friedrichs herself is a teacher, I believe, in Orange County. The defendants in the lawsuit are the California Teachers Association. And we here in California have had a lot of experience with these campaigns to eliminate the so-called agency fee in public employee unions. Governor Schwarzenegger, when he was in office, went after this a couple of times. Conservative organizations in California have put these sorts of bills on the ballot a couple of times. They've been defeated, but this is a real threat to a long-standing precedent that the Supreme Court set some years ago that's known as the Abood precedent that accepted, that legalized, that validated these sort of agency fees. And the issue here is that you can't be forced as a member of a teachers union or any public union to support the political activities of that union, but you can be forced to support the activities of that union that benefit you, whether you are a member or a non-member. And that includes collective bargaining for wages and work conditions. So in California, we do have a process for teachers and other public employees to opt out of full dues, to opt out of membership in the union, but they are required to pay the expenses that the union incurs in protecting them from as employees of public agencies.
Well, this does look like what's called Supreme Court shopping, that this small group in Washington, the Center for Individual Rights, which is a conservative group, they wanted to bring this issue before the High Court, and they found a way. And, of course, they found sympathetic ears with particularly Justice Samuel Alito, who's many times indicated that he sees these union fees as unconstitutional because they require some employees to support a cause they oppose. I imagine it takes four justices to take a case, right?
Well, that's true. It only takes four, and of course it takes five to rule one way or another, or if you can't get a majority of five, then the lower court decision stands. And in this case, the lower court decision upheld these agency fees. And as you said, the Center for Individual Rights actually asked for that ruling so that they could bring this case to the Supreme Court. I think what's interesting here is that the concerns that advocates for workers, for public employees have about the court are concerns about whether the court is going to take a political step. And that resembles the concerns that people had over the Obamacare case that the court just ruled on last week, in which the question of whether tax subsidies could be granted to individuals in states that didn't have their own individual insurance exchange, whether that was legal. I think most intelligent, most informed legal commentary was held that was a ridiculous position, that of course the law said that subsidies would be available to all Americans based on their income alone. The concerns that people had were that the court would step away from from the legal rationales and make a political judgment about the Affordable Care Act and essentially undermine it or overturn it. And it seems to me that that's the same issue that people have today. Abood is a very strong precedent. It has stood up over time. The question is whether somehow there's a majority in the court that has an animus toward public employee unions to the extent that it will use this case to undermine the unions seriously.
Well, we know that four of these Supreme Court justices have such an animus. I mean, isn't that a reasonable assumption?
Well, it is, although let's not forget that in the King v. Burwell case, the Obamacare case, four justices clearly voted to accept the case, but only three ended up ruling in favor of the plaintiffs, and a majority of six ruled to uphold the law as it's written. So you don't know. Sometimes it's not unusual for a justice to rule to vote to take a case because he or she wants to get a firm decision whichever way it goes, but we'll vote on the other side when the case actually comes up.
But essentially what's happening here, given the people who fund this Center for Individual Rights, these wealthy individuals out for ideological reasons, it does seem a case where, and this has been, in fact, stated by the president of the National Education Association, Lily Eskenden Garcia, and the American Federation of Teachers president, Randy Weingarten, saying, "We are disappointed that at a time when big corporations and the wealthy few are rewriting the rules in their favor, knocking American families and our entire economy off balance, the Supreme Court has chosen to take a case that threatens the fundamental promise of America that if you work hard and play by the rules, you should be able to provide for your family and live a decent life." I mean, isn't this what's going on here, that if you take away collective bargaining, as Scott Walker did, largely, I think, to burnish his conservative resumes to run for president, it just seems sort of callous that people are hurting the lives of a lot of people in order to score an ideological point.
Well, they are trying to score an ideological point, and I think it's very smart of the – I mean, I think the teacher union – leaders are exactly right. This is a real threat to unions. It's a real threat to collective bargaining in the public sector. And that means it's a threat to the wages and work conditions of all of those public employees. I think that's well recognized. And as I said, I think the union leadership, and in fact most attorneys who are advocates for workers, would say that if the court were to rule basically on precedent and the law, they would uphold these agency fees. But the concern is that the ruling or the decision is going to be swayed by ideological leanings by five justices at least. And that's a real concern and a legitimate one.
Well, it's always struck me as extraordinary that Scott Walker is, I think he's polling as number two, closely behind Jeb Bush in the crowded Republican presidential sweepstakes. And his claim to his constituency, whatever it is, whether it's the Koch brothers or the Republican primary voters or whoever, his claim to fame is that I stood up against 100,000 of my own angry citizens. And, you know, basically what he's done is he has lowered the standard of living of his constituents. It doesn't make any sense to me. It certainly doesn't make any sense to be something to be proud of.
Well, as you pointed out, he's playing to his base and he's playing to his patrons. His patrons in this case, well, they don't have any regard for public employees. They don't have any regard for private employees either. They're the Koch brothers. They are basically talking their book and they're paying to support their way of life and their ideology. They've got a candidate who is doing their bidding, not only Walker but many others in the Republican field, and yes, we can say it's cynical, we can say it's dishonest, we can say it's appalling, but that's the Republican Party, especially when we are in the period of primaries. That's what the strongest, the most well-heeled base wants, and that's what these candidates are playing to. I think what you're going to see is candidates on the other side, that is the Democratic side, are going to fight against this
very, very strongly. Hillary Clinton already is showing that she's willing to take up this cudgel. Certainly Bernie Sanders is in that camp. And we will see, you know, who the American public wants, which way the American public wants to vote.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Michael Hilsick, I just want to touch on your recent column about Uber, because the state of California's labor regulators have pulled Uber over. We saw really hostile and violent demonstrations in Paris against Uber, and they hauled Uber executives into a parliamentary inquiry in Paris. They're not getting treated quite that way here in the United States. But what I find extraordinary about what you reveal in this article is that Uber's, and Uber has proven from the remarks by its CEO, to be fairly libertarian in a way that would make the Koch brothers happy. They have hired as their chief strategist, Uber, former White House aide David Plouffe. I'm astounded. I mean, I thought these guys are supposed to be Democrats, supposed to be advocates for working Americans. Uber's its whole business model is to essentially downsize working Americans and make them independent contractors so that they get no benefits whatsoever.
Well, right. Well, you know, I can't look into David Plouffe's heart, but I'm sure they're paying him very well. He's become sort of the face of Uber, which needed a kinder, gentler face. But you're right. Companies like Uber, they talk a lot about bringing freedom and liberty and flexibility to the worker, but they really are at heart exploiting these workers by capturing a clear 20% of the workers' income and sticking the workers with all the expenses that typically in an employer-employee relationship the employer pays for. Everything from, and not just Uber, but many other companies, the employee now has to pay for his or her vehicle, gas, maintenance, sometimes uniforms, and has to comply with the company's dress code, work hours, what have you. They don't have as much freedom as these companies would like to claim. They really are, in everything but name, employees. And I think what we're going to see as time goes on, in this country certainly, we're going to see an evolution of that relationship, because I think regulators and ultimately workers are not going to be happy with the terms as they are today.
Well, Michael Hilsick, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, it's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Hilsick, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times, where he writes the daily blog The Economy Hub. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry, and he writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, which covers business and economic issues relevant to life in California. And his books include Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century, and The New Deal, A Modern History. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the latest entrant into the Republican presidential primary race, Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Hennelly, who is a contributing writer to Salon, and he is a reporter for CBS News' Money Watch and a political analyst at WBGO, an NPR affiliate in Newark, New Jersey. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Hennelly.
Thanks for having me. It's a real honor.
And the I don't know what number he is, 13th, 14th, 15th Republican presidential hopeful to announce he's running in the Republican presidential primaries in 2016. Of course, your governor, Chris Christie, who you've followed for some time, Bob.
Yes.
He made his announcement at his alma mater, Livingston High School in Livingston, New Jersey, that he's going to fight for the people of the United States of America. I mean, I don't know how this guy's ever going to get around. He says he's going to fight for the people of America, but he screwed up a whole bunch of people who were trying to get to work on a very busy bridge. And I just don't know how he's going to get out from under that. Do you think he's ever gotten out from under Bridgegate?
Well, I think that actually it's his tenure when it comes to the economy, which is really creating ongoing problems for the people of New Jersey and will make it very difficult for the person that comes after him, his successor. It's very important to understand that one of the things that has been going on in New Jersey is really a continuation of their Great Recession. By the numbers, New Jersey's only added 72% of its the jobs it lost in the recession compared to neighboring Pennsylvania at 113%, average in the U.S. 135%, and then Governor Cuomo's performance, very robust, 275% of the jobs from the lost during the Great Recession have been restored. So this is really, if you look at the category, for instance, of foreclosures, a very important study came out of Berkeley looking at all of the collapse, really the continued demise of the mortgage market in urban America, primarily in communities of color, in the nation. Out of the five metropolitan areas with the highest level of underwater mortgages, where the mortgage is at least 25% higher than the actual value of the property, three of those cities out of the five are located in New Jersey. So that means you have Newark, Paterson, and Elizabeth. When you do beat reporting, as I'm fortunate to do, and go out into these communities, what that means is that individuals are living on blocks where every other home is boarded up. In some cases, people are squatting in them. I did a terrible story 3 years ago. A family of five was killed by a fire that had been started in a vacant property next door in Newark. This is the New Jersey of the 21st century, which for some reason the national media just doesn't seem to cover.
So you've also covered this other scandal of the sweetheart deal that Christie made with Exxon, who were liable for billions for polluting New Jersey, and he gave them an incredible gift, reducing their liability by, 1,000% or something.
Oh, it's huge. That you're referring to what was supposed to be Exxon, of course, got its start, Standard Oil, in Bayonne, New Jersey. And historically, going back to the 19th century, it had dumped all kinds of, you know, pesticides, chemicals. In fact, at one point, those wetlands actually were turned over by the state to Exxon, Standard Oil, because it was believed at one time that wetlands were the source of disease, and there was a public policy to actually develop them. But as a consequence, what we had was generations of toxic waste dumped in these places, and Governor Christie's his predecessors were in court. They successfully, the state had passed the liability stage where a court had ruled actually that Exxon was liable for this pollution, and all that remained was a settlement. The state was contemplating a $9 billion number, and right on the brink of what was to be a settlement for something, Governor Christie announced, I might add, after he got a half million dollar contribution for the Republican Governors Association, that there had been a settlement for $225 million for natural resource damage claims. What's very important for people to understand is that this is not the remediation issue, and Christie, the master of sophistry, has tried to confuse the two. Exxon is already on the hook to clean up these sites in Linden and Bayonne, and that's a matter of black letter law. This was to settle what's called a natural resource damage claim, and what people don't fully understand is that this is a concept that has its roots in Justinian Code, in the Magna Carta, and confirmed by the Supreme Court, that when a natural resource like a wetlands or water or air, these things are held, if you will, in trust by the state. And when a private party destroys them and degrades them, there must be compensation, and that's what this is about. And the big tragedy is that this money would have gone to restore 30,000 acres of wetlands and marshlands in New Jersey, which would have been a great way of preventing the kind of damage we saw with Sandy, where this 13-foot wall of water came in and destroyed much of our critical infrastructure.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Henley, who is a contributing writer to Salon, and he is a reporter for CBS News' Money Watch and a political analyst at WBGO, an NPR affiliate in Newark, New Jersey. And we're talking about the entry of Chris Christie, Governor Christie, into the Republican presidential primaries race of 2016. I think he's at 14th. I just did the count to enter. But he's really hobbled by the fact that, aside from Donald Trump, he has the highest negative rating of any of these candidates.
Well, and that's funny you should say, because one of the things is the tragedy of Chris Christie is that I will say there was a moment in time where if he had made his commitment and redeemed his promise that he made with the unions for reform of the public pensions, he indeed would be able to have something to offer the United States. It's important for people to know that he did manage at one point in time to get Democratic Senate President Steve Sweeney, at the time Assembly Speaker Sheila Oliver, Democrats pro-labor, to come to the table, make major concessions. They did indeed raise the retirement age. Public employees did increase their contributions for their fringe benefits. And all that the governor had to do was to make pension payments and catch up the program, and he failed to do that. And so I submit this is tragic. Had he done that, it would be a very different story.
So when Christie takes a swipe at Hillary Clinton, saying after 7 years of a weak and feckless foreign policy, we better not turn it over to Obama's second mate, Hillary Clinton. I mean, it's got a sort of nasty ring to it, but I think it's going to fall flat, isn't it?
Well, I think also that people who are astute observers understand that when it comes to foreign policy and muscularity, if anything, there's been a total continuity. If a listener to your program is regaled with detail about the continuity between the Obama administration and the Bush administration, we've seen this. And so we had a war on terrorism, and we have proliferated terrorism. So, I think this is, he would have been better to zero in on the class issues and on things like the fact that the Clinton campaign, according to The Guardian, is using, interns, unpaid interns. That would have been a payday for Christie.
So the fact that he appeared to hang out his subordinates to dry and have them take the fall, how's that playing in the state of New Jersey? It's not exactly the sign of a mensch, is it?
Well, no. I think also you have to look ahead to what is going to be a series of show trials in that will just drive the regional news wave. You have three individuals in the form of Mr. Wildstein, who's admitted his role in it, who is a lieutenant of Christie's and was in the Port Authority, Bill Baroni, former state senator, a top election lawyer for Republicans, another confidant of Christie in Port Authority, and then Bridget Kelly is one of his key players. They're all going to be involved in courtroom drama all summer, doing everything they can to undermine each other. So this is not going away, and it will continue, and Christie will surface throughout that whole trial procedure.
Well, as I was saying at the beginning, Bob, I still can't believe that he did what he did. The Bridgegate thing happened, and it was such an example of the worst of petty politics and the most egregious example of a total disregard for the very constituents that you're supposed to serve.
Well, and also the fact that, and I don't understand why the U.S. attorney didn't act on this, but the fact that it happened on the anniversary of September 11th, from my standpoint, in one of the most critical terrorist targets in the world, that should have been an aggravating factor, and they should all be, that should be part of the mix of the criminal sanctions they're facing.
So there's clearly a big gap between Chris Christie's ego and the reality that surrounds him. So is he in a bubble? Does he have any idea of how he's fallen from grace and how unpopular he is?
Well, the thing is that he is a master performer. If you don't know actually his track record, he is engaging. He has the ability to hold the room, and he can, and this is a tremendous advantage over the rest of the hothouse flyers that are going to be running, who could not take the rough and tumble of a extemporaneous circumstance where you're actually in a room with the great unwashed. I've seen him do it, and to that degree, he's talented. And he can take control of the room and manage to work the room. And that's something that's, you know, I wouldn't underestimate that skill.
Well, it's certainly a skill that's lacking in the front runner, Jeb Bush.
Well, exactly. And that's, and we'll see how that goes up in New Hampshire. But his track record in New Jersey, from an economic standpoint, is just a trail of misery and continues to be so.
So he's up in New Hampshire now, isn't he? Didn't he?
Right. I guess he was leaving today. The event was in Livingston, and I didn't take a look at his itinerary, but I think he's going to have, he's really putting all of his chips on New Hampshire. That's where he's got his field organization ramped up. And, you know, I think that I don't know how he presses on if he doesn't do well there.
But where's his money coming from?
Well, I mean, traditionally, he's been very close to Wall Street and to folks that are, you know, involved with things like the Vulture Funds, people that were very much involved with and the architects around, you know, financial manipulation that has really gotten us into the pickle we're in.
Well, isn't New Jersey a kind of backdoor to Wall Street?
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of job loss, but that's true. It does have it's not quite as big an impact because of the shrinking of the footprint of employment. But no, you're right. They still have a lot of sway in the regional mix. But I mean, it's just incredible just how many. There's like 10,000 zombie homes in New Jersey. I mean, even in I happen to live in the same town as the governor, wealthy rural suburb, and there are, you know, house after house where no one's living in them, and they're falling apart. I mean, this is the reality. And unfortunately, and this is part of the general critique of the media in general, we have not recovered. And we're in denial that we haven't. And so now that we're looking at this global situation, just look at the lack of youth employment participation. Those were the numbers you have to see. And so Christie's situation in New Jersey, hopefully I do think maybe it'll come to light more, but it's going to continue to implode. I mean, Atlantic City, there's been a 48% decline in property values, and they responded to that by raising property taxes 20%. I mean, that's not the recipe for a going concern.
Well, it just seems, though, that if his only support is on the bottom feeders on Wall Street, you know, I can't imagine that those guys want to bet on a loser.
Well, I mean, it's also relatively, it's early. I mean, it's important to know that his brother is also, Todd, is very much tied in with Wall Street. Chris Christie came to prominence, actually got his first big job. He was what we call a freeholder, which is the county office, and then worked as a lobbyist, as a lawyer slash fixer slash lobbyist. But his claim to fame was that he was what they call a Bush pioneer, in that he raised six figures, and that's basically how he came to the attention of Bush and ended up getting the appointment as U.S. attorney. Prior to that, he had never even been tried a criminal case.
Well, Robert Henley, I thank you very much for filling us in on the latest Republican entrant into the crowded field of presidential candidates.
Thanks so much. Really enjoyed it.
I did too. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Henley, who is a contributing writer to Salon, and he is also a reporter for CBS News' Money Watch and a political analyst for WBGO, an NPR affiliate in Newark, New Jersey. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.